You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Henry Rhys Sheridan, standing in this week for Josh Fennett. On today's show, we riff on the theme of independence and bring you three design-minded stories that show businesses breaking the mould and doing things their own way. First up, we sit down with interior designer and Fermdale Hotel's co-founder, Kit Kemp. She talks us through her use of textiles and the future of fabrics, and we examine the interiors of her latest book.
It's very important the way you feel. And your surroundings are then vitally important. So I think what I'm doing is making a feeling that when you open the door, there's a feeling of welcome and well-being.
Next, we meet an accessories outfitter that's making the most of its domestic production to weave a new way in business. We talk to the creative director of London-based Taylor Drakes about the decision to grow into the children's wear market.
Essentially, it's making things in exactly the same way to the same standards that we make for our men's line, for really the sons of our customers.
Then we head to Melbourne to investigate a derelict warehouse turned pleasure palace for carnivores. Hospitality entrepreneur and designer Lindsay Jones-Evans introduces us to his newest restaurant, Meatworks. And finally, we check in on a business that has been going its own way for quite some time now. Austrian crystal maker Swarovski is 120 years old this year. Monocle correspondent Alexei Korolyov marks the occasion with a profile of the company. All that coming up right here on Section D, here on Monocle 24. First up on the show, we talk hospitality and how to mingle formality, flair, fabrics, and textures in the design of a successful interior. Fermdale Hotels operates 9 hotels in total, 8 are in London, including the Ham Yard Hotel in Soho, and 1, the Crosby Street Hotel, is in New York. Founded by partners Tim and Kit Kemp, the properties have become firm favourites with design-minded travellers. Last week, interior designer and one half of the founding Fermdale duo Kit Kemp launched a second book with Aussie imprint Hardy Grant entitled Every Room Tells a Story. Monocle's Josh Fennett sat down with her to discuss the future of fabric in hotel rooms and learn more about the secret to creating an alluring interior.
Interior design is not brain surgery, but it's often sort of relegated to the back. It's very important the way you feel, and your surroundings are then vitally important. So I think what I'm doing is making a feeling that when you open the door, there's a feeling of welcome and well-being, and that's most important, and I think that's sort of sometimes not really appreciated.
Absolutely, and the title of your book implies that rooms tell different stories. I wonder if when you're making a public space and when you're making a private space, there are different design decisions that you make, so between a hotel lobby, say, or a hotel room, or even a room in your own home.
I think when I'm doing commercial spaces, and very often we're working from plans, working with the architects to begin with for the whole concept, and there has to be a sort of thread, an intelligent thread that runs through the building that makes our work congruent so that there's a feel throughout. But within a commercial space, it can be much more dramatic. So people who are going through, who are not necessarily have a great feel for the aesthetics around them, suddenly would stop and look at something. And if they do that, then I feel that we've achieved something.
Absolutely. And your work is obviously, along with your husband, Tim, part of the Fermdale Hotel Groups. Could you tell me a little potted history of how you guys came to basically develop such an amazing, independent, wonderful, you know, kind of hotel business, and how it started and where it is today?
Right. Well, it started when we were little more than students. Tim had a short lease on a building which actually had hotel use. So he linked it with an American college, the Richmond College. And so we had students staying. And it was really great fun because we used to have sort of guitar playing and barbecue in a garden at the back. But we decided at that point that we didn't really like staying in hotels and that we would try and make a hotel that we would like to stay in, which would be much more individual, much smaller than most of the hotels at that time. So they named them boutique hotels. And we started from there. It was a bit like Topsy, just grew and grew.
And that's the kind of the broad brushstrokes of the hospitality industry in which you find yourself. But it's the interiors of these rooms for which you've garnered a great reputation for making hospitable spaces, and particularly through the use of textiles. I wonder if you can tell me about your kind of background in it, where you find the inspiration for these pieces and where you actually, you know, source them, where they come from.
Well, they come from all over the world because I've always loved textiles. And when I was working, at one time I was actually working in shipping, so I used to travel around the world quite a bit. But wherever I went, I always collected textiles and looked at the bright colours and the way that they can be combined. And I couldn't find a lot of the time things that I wanted to use. And so then you become much more inventive and you can start creating things and creating a signature of your own style.
And has there been, do you think, a kind of renaissance in the appreciation of fabrics? I mean, for one thing, the particular manner in which these things are made, the idea that the provenance of them may be important or they may say something wider about the kind of culture from which they come. There was probably a time a number of years ago when people would be thinking about stripping out the fabrics and, you know, putting in a much more kind of austere, woody, kind of simple, clean, clear aesthetic. Do you think there's been a shift back towards fabrics and the kind of materiality and the different colours and the kind of texture that they create?
Well, I'm very interested in art and I love paintings, and it's very interesting to talk to people within the art world, but they've always rather relegated craft. And I feel that craft is most important. And so lots of our people that we're using and lots of the weavers are very sort of small-time, intrinsic people of their races, whether they come from Guatemala or Argentina or just down the road in Brixton. Doesn't matter. But I love their work. And it doesn't matter also that their colours change slightly as they re-dye things. It's a bit of soul that comes within the fabric itself.
And finally, you're here in part because of the release of a wonderful new book from Aussie imprint Hardy Grant, which is released with your name on it. Can you tell me a little bit about the process by which the book came about and what we can expect were we to dive under the covers?
Right. Well, it's the second book. The first book was A Living Space. The name came from a curated exhibition that I did for Contemporary Applied Arts, and then things grew from there. And the second book, Every Room Tells a Story, is actually looking at the projects that we do, because some of them are greenfield sites. They start from a hole in the ground. So there's the original concept of the building, the architecture itself. And then when it's completed, you should walk into a room or a space and feel as if it's just always been there. If somebody says to me, did you have to do very much here? I always say, no, not really. Didn't do very much at all. And that's good because it just feels as if it's meant to be.
That was interior designer and Ferndale Hotels co-founder Kit Kemp speaking to Monocle's Josh Fennett about her new book, Every Room Tells a Story, which is out now. Next, we ponder the upside of owning your own factory when it comes to moving your firm forward. Since 1977, British menswear specialist Drakes has prided itself on provenance. Alongside its apparel and accessories, the company added a new factory to its books and launched a slick new shirting line in 2013. Now it has its sights set on a growing market, children's wear. Michael Hill, Drake's creative director, sat down with Monocle's Josh Fennett to discuss the future of formality and why being in complete control of the products you manufacture is a mature decision.
We're fairly well established in terms of our menswear, predominantly with our own made shirts and ties. And we felt there was a real opportunity there with the boys' shirts and ties. We're not simply doing it because we have the factories. Of course, it's a huge help, the fact that we do manufacture ourselves locally, and we're very much working in the midst of both of our factories, which gives us the opportunity to be very flexible and hands-on and create the product that we very much believe in and understand the manufacturing of. But I think we genuinely felt that we could add a product that there was a demand for. It's something that we were being asked for by our customers.
Absolutely. And if you could give us a little bit of a kind of overview of the collection. So what can we expect? Are these children going to be trussed up with ruches? Are they going to be wearing ties?
Well, I suppose that we've kept it really fairly straightforward. To us, it made sense to stick closely to what we do with the Drake's men's collection. So button-down shirts, soft collar, a spread collar, as well as an overshirt in a chambray. So a couple of classic Oxford button-downs, something slightly more formal with a spread collar, and then 3, 4, 5 ties, which go back to the sorts of qualities that we do very well with, that we believe in, And essentially, it's making things in exactly the same way to the same standards that we make for our men's line, for really the sons of our customers. And it's those chaps who seem to be asking us for something that is, that I suppose they know the provenance of. They believe in us and in what we do and what we make. And I think they want the same thing for their sons. And that's very nice and very reassuring.
Absolutely. And what most people would know about Drake's is that it's a kind of long-held commitment to the provenance of your materials and the kind of the art of making beautiful gentlemen's clothes. You guys started in the late 70s.
That's right.
You've got a factory in London. And then 2 years ago, you invested in a kind of a newer venture, which is the shirting side of the business,
right,
which you talked about. But I wonder if you can tell me how much easier it is to turn around a project like this quickly and efficiently when you own the means of production. And do you think that's a trend in the fashion industry that people are starting to identify, that owning your own factory is useful if you want to be reactive and if you want to really know your product from start to finish?
I think so. Increasingly, more and more, we're seeing it. I think it's all very well wanting authenticity to be part of your brand because it's a trendy thing to be, but I think it goes far deeper than that. And I think there's really meaning within it, to the extent that if you're making something that you understand and you believe in and the product is credible, then I think it's far easier for your customer to relate to that. And I think if you have a story that you are essentially proud to tell, there's hopefully something compelling in that message and therefore in that product as well. We're very proud to be making locally, to be making ourselves and to be making a long-term investment. It's not something that we look for a quick return on. It does take time. Yes, we can go into the factory and make these samples in relatively quick time, and we can be very hands-on and flexible in that regard, and that's incredibly helpful to us. But actually, in terms of looking at it as an overall business, it's certainly not something we've gone into thinking, well, this is something that we look to make a success of in one or two seasons. No, I think we take a very long-term view on it, and we hope to ultimately see that return. But we know that it will take time, not least because we're not cutting any corners, and it takes a great deal of investment to put the infrastructure in place.
Sure. And Michael, you're a very dapper chap, and the accessories that Drake's make are very formal. I wonder if for the year ahead, and I know it's a slightly unfair question, do you think people are taking more interest in formality? I mean, there has been a number of years where it's become increasingly acceptable to, say, not wear leather shoes to a meeting, or to not wear a tie, or to go loose collared. Do you think there's any resurgence in formality? Because, you know, providing a children's wear line is a sort of statement about that.
Yeah.
You know, should children be wearing their Sunday best more often, and is there a market for it? I mean, do you see 2016 as a year of formality?
Well, I think it's fairly fluid in that regard. It's clearly something that we believe in, there's no question about it, but we're not out there saying, look, this is what you or your son has to wear every day of the week. It's the same in menswear. I think, yes, we're in the formal menswear world, but I think our formal wear has edges that are somewhat softened, that are somewhat a little more casual, a little more comfortable, and I think it's the same for what we're doing for boys. So I think, yes, there are times when you would want your son to look very smart and presentable, but we do understand that that's not necessarily all day, every day. I think there's a demand for beautifully made, hopefully in our case, locally sourced product that is made with an awful lot of love. And those, I think, are products that have their place. And we're saying, well, when you do want to buy beautiful things, why not consider something that's been well thought out and beautifully made?
That was Michael Hill, Creative Director of Drake's, talking to Josh Fennett about the company's dapper new line of children's clothing, which launched this week. Still to come on the show, a Melbourne factory reimagined and redesigned as a meat-centric eatery, and a report on Austrian crystal makers Swarovski in the company's 120th year. Do keep listening.
Magic and realism are constant themes in Miami. Our new Monocle travel guide to Miami explores this alchemy and shares the knowledge we've acquired from our regular pilgrimages down south.
There is a ridiculous amount of choice when it comes to hotels. The best options are on Miami Beach, often Art Deco gems with retro swimming pools and private beaches. This is Miami, so expect a few little flashy details that you might not get in other US cities. And take advantage of them. That's what you're here for, isn't it?
Nowhere in the US feels quite like Miami. Take a peek by watching our Miami Travel Guide film, now showing on Monocle.com.
Good design is appreciated through the senses, and in this regard, the importance of sight and touch, of course, can't be understated. But for hospitality entrepreneur Lindsay Jones-Evans, sound, smell, and even taste are of equal vitality. So much so that he's crafted a whole new haven combining all five of them. The rattling old warehouse doors of Meatworks have just rolled open in the former industrial borough of Australia's South Melbourne. What was once a 1930s panel-beating garage has undergone an epic transformation, maintaining its historical eminence whilst introducing a modern, fresh coolness. And it was all hammered together by the hands of Lindsay himself over a 15-month period. Monocle's Melbourne contributor Stephen A. Russell caught up with the former set designer in the busy Meatworks kitchen to discuss the restaurant's overlapping sensory pleasures.
One component of it is the fact that it is in a back street. I've never liked a venture or any venture being on a main street, for instance. That's just not on, so far as I'm concerned. It doesn't have any particular or special kudos about it. And I love warehouse space, which this is what this is all about. It's a great initial platform to do a great design in.
And I guess that is one of the joys of working with a warehouse, is you kind of have a big box. So tell me a little bit about what you kept of that space initially.
Sure. Well, it was a painted concrete floor. It was painted brick walls and a tin roof. So it was very, very elementary. My first impression was to keep the fabric, not over-design, where I eradicate all the things that are not right with the space. For instance, you can still see there's lighting sort of hanging out of the wall and there's chips and broken brick. So I've retained all those sort of features to make it not so precious, because for me there's nothing worse than a precious fit out. It's kind of too controlled and kind of boring.
Did you work with an architect or other designer, or were you sort of sketching ideas yourself?
Well, I'm a qualified industrial designer, which I did many years ago. And I was a production designer in film and television, mainly TV commercials and small films. So designing interiors, designing theatrics, designing special effects, it's all kind of second nature to me. So I brought that sort of design background into my hospitality, and I design every interior that of any every business that I've had.
And so how much of that element of theatre is sort of applicable in hospitality then?
I think if you don't have that theatre or that attraction, I think it's limited. I think that you've really got to appeal to human beings' five senses. And if you miss out on one of those particular five senses, because we are human beings and that's who we're designing these spaces for, it just won't work. You won't have the X factor, which is what I always try to strive for.
Maybe we could talk about some of the little details. I mean, when you walk in, there are ladders sort of leading you in from which are hanging fern-like plant pots, and you've got some incredible big light fixtures and some sort of industrial-looking machinery here and there.
Yeah.
Tell me about some of your favourite little details and how what you created them from.
Sure. They're the things that excite me because I'm a big collector. I like to collect industrial, you know, machine lights and industrial furniture, tables, ladders, anything that's kind of had a sort of a history to it and an industrial style to it, I find really exciting. And not only have I collected it from Australia, I've collected it from around the world as well. And I've hoarded this stuff, knowing full well that, you know, my new venture will encompass all these elements designed together. Not just in a kind of piece together way either. I mean, like, things are adapted, so they might be cut down and they might be restructured, and then they might be painted to blend in with the existing colour scheme. It's not just juxtaposed bits and pieces to decorate a space.
One of the sort of elements that seems to bring warmth to the design for me is the use of wood in the space. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about that.
The walls are cream, so that's a nice, it's a comforting colour. It's not jarring, it's comforting. And the floors are a rough ground concrete, so that's a beautiful brown colour. And so are the timber tops on the chairs and the table. So you get the warmth through the natural timber, juxtaposed against the nice cream walls and, you know, soft lighting.
One of the things I love about the space is, you know, you've kind of embraced that idea of the kitchen as theatre, but it also has these fantastic kind of almost school classroom like glass windows in front of it. Tell me about that element.
Well, you know, you can have an exposed kitchen, which is good, but you want to diffuse it with panes of glass because that picks up light and kind of does this kind of menagerie kind of feel. So you're viewing through something, which kind of breaks it up a little bit, which you know, it's almost a little bit in disguise. So it's just more, a bit more magical than just having nothing there.
And as a designer, what are your main influences? You know, what excited you when you sort of began this journey?
I got excited by a lot of different design trends. The one that I dislike the most is the one in the 80s, where it was a lot of facadism, I call it, where they'd have a building and they bolt on this kind of monstrous steel latticework on the front to kind of embellish it. That I find horrific because it doesn't do anything except for be an embellishment. So I like things that are very integral and very honest. I think as soon as design comes out of the form that follows function and it becomes superfluous, I don't like going down that road. But I really like to keep it, you know, it should be a part of its function. Design should follow function as opposed to the other way around.
And so can we look forward to see you continuing to dabble in all of these interests from design to set flourishes to hospitality?
I think so. I think I'm here to stay for a while. And if someone, for instance, handed me this space and said, here you are, Lindsay, here's your beautifully designed space, now you can have the key and you can start operating, I don't think I'd want to do it. I have to be involved from the very start. It has to be part of me. I think that's key for me.
That was Monocle's Melbourne contributor, Stephen A. Russell, talking to hospitality entrepreneur Lindsay Jones-Evans about his new venture, Meatworks. Next on the show, we look at how going your own way doesn't only apply to box-fresh new businesses. The Austrian crystal maker Swarovski started a revolution in glass cutting and jewellery when it was founded in 1895 by Daniel Swarovski. This year, the firm, based in the picturesque Tyrolean Alps, celebrates 120 years of forging its own path. Throughout this long history, its crystals have shone and sparkled in the work of some of the world's greatest designers, as well as classic Hollywood productions and landmark buildings, including the Metropolitan Opera House in New York and the Palace of Versailles outside Paris. Our man in Austria, Alexei Korolev, looked at the past, present and future of the still family-owned enterprise and how the household name is defying convention to keep its sparkle.
I'm at the Swarovski flagship store in Vienna, where tonight a lavish new book is being launched that looks at the firm's 120-year history. It's all glittering and shiny, and with the Viennese beau monde all out in force too.
Guten Abend, liebe Damen und Herren. Guten Abend, Freunde des Hauses Swarovski.
Thank you.
Among the speakers is celebrated Dutch product designer Tord Bontier, whose relationship with Swarovski goes back years.
Well, I started working with Swarovski in 2002, when Nadia Swarovski asked me to think about chandeliers. At that time, chandeliers were very unromantic, and our idea was to bring romance back into chandeliers. And the result of this first project was the Blossom Chandelier. Then after the Blossom Chandelier, we also made another chandelier called the Ice Branch. I also worked together with Alexander McQueen to design a Christmas tree for the Victor and Albert Museum, which is completely made out of Swarovski crystal. And then in 2006, I designed an installation in the Innsbruck shop called Wind of Wonderland. This was this fantasy landscape completely made of crystal about fairy tales. And although it was meant to be there for 1 year, it was so popular that it remained there for 4 or 5 years.
Tord is one of a long line of famous designers that have worked with Swarovski over the years. And he says it hasn't come easy.
Well, not only as a designer, but as anybody, you see crystal for the first time and you go like, wow, that's an amazing material, and it's glitzy and very attractive and sexy. But then as a designer, then you also think, okay, what would I like to do with it? Because after the first 3 seconds of the wow factor, it's also a very kitschy material, and the most horrible things imaginable have been made in crystal as well. So it's a very tricky material. It can easily get the better of you. So to find a way in which the positive qualities of the crystal, the sparkle, are used, I think that's something that not many designers can actually do. It takes a sensitivity. It's a material that's so alive, it's very easy to overstate.
So
Swarovski began life in 1895, when Daniel Swarovski and his in-law, Franz Weiss, moved to the sleepy Tyrolean village of Wattens from their old home in Bohemia, at the time the epicenter of crystal cutting in Europe. The pair came equipped with a patent for a revolutionary new electric cutting machine and big ambitions. They didn't exactly get off to a good start, though. In his memoirs, Swarovski recalls that at first the villagers regarded the new settlers with a certain reserve. Well, little did they know, over the past 120 years, Swarovski has become one of the most recognizable brand names in the world, and Wattens itself transformed beyond measure. The family enterprise is now in its fifth generation, with stores in 170 countries and an annual revenue of over 3 billion euros. To coincide with the big anniversary, Swarovski has also relaunched its museum in Wattens, opened in 1995 to mark the firm's centenary. It's called Swarovski Kristallwelten, or Crystal Worlds, and I spoke to its creative director, Carla Rumler.
Hello, how are you?
She began by telling me how the company had changed since she first joined it 15 years ago.
Well, the company has developed incredibly. Swarovski has always been dealing with or cooperating with great artists since the company was founded. The founder already collaborated with Christian Dior, with Coco Chanel, but it was more in a B2B way. And since that, it developed a lot. So in 1995, we opened the Kristallwelten, which was incredibly new and incredibly exciting. And since that, we developed the Kristallwelten further from quite a small museum into, let's say, a big experience with his restaurants, with his garden. Also, the collaborations with designers, they have been developed further. And of course, we all benefit from that because we have an incredibly network of very, very interesting designers, renowned and upcoming.
Swarovski is one of the very few Austrian companies that have embraced novel advertising techniques such as sonic branding. Here's a recent Swarovski showreel featuring music made by Vienna-based sound experience agency called Raven & Finch. But for all its innovativeness, Carla says, at heart Swarovski is still a genuine family affair.
Well, of course, the family business is always very special, and the Swarovski family has always been caring for the people, for the employees, have always been caring for nature, have always been caring and collaborating with artists. So this is behavior in the house of Swarovski, which, of course, is very important and interesting, and it makes you feel part of this community. It has been developed, it's now the fifth generation, but it's still a family business. And you can feel that when you work for Swarovski, there is passion. You will find a lot of people with passion for this house, for the family. It's very, very different, I think, than other businesses.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our producer Ben Ryland and editor Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, please do drop me a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at exactly the same time. You can always listen again or brush up on our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.